बिहारे। गोपी जन बल्लभ गिरिवर धारे, गोपी जन बल्लभ गिरिवर धारे, यशोद नंदन ब्रज जन रंजन, यशोद नंदन ब्रज जन रंजन, जमुना तीरावन चारी, जमुना तीरावन चारी, जय राधा माधव सिंह बिहारी, राधा माधव कुंज बिहारी, गोपी जन बल्लभ गिरिवर धारे, गिरिवर धारे गिरिराज नारायण, गोपी जन बल्लभ गिरिवर धारे, यशोद नंदन ब्रज जन रंजन, यशोद नंदन ब्रज जन रंजन, समुन तीरावन चारी, समुन तीरावन चारी, जय राधा माधव कुंज बिहारी,
signs up there in front, but they're all... Jaya Vishnu... All right, geez, when can I start? Jaya Vishnupada Paramahamsa Arya Jakacharya Sota 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 Sri Srimad A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Maharaj Prabhupada Ki Dhanacharya of Iskcon Shri Prabhupada Ki Jaya Vishnupada Paramahamsa Arya Jakacharya Sota Sota Sri Srimad Bhaktivedanta Sarasati Goswami Maharaj Prabhupada Ki. Namachara Sri Haridas Thakur Ki. Praise Sekha Ho Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gadadhar Saraswati Gaura Bhakta Vinda Ki. Sri Sri Radha Krishna Gopi Gopinath Shamakun Radhakun Giri Govardhan Ki. Sri Mayapuram Ki. Sri Vrindavandan Ki. Gangamai Ki. Yamunamai Ki. Bhakti Devi Ki. Tulsi Devi Ki. Ananta Koti Vaishnav, Vrinda Ki, Sri Harinam Sankirtan Ki, Maranta Raja Srimad Bhagavatam Ki, Sama Maida Vaktavinda Ki, Gora Premanande, all glories to the Sama Devotees, all glories to the Sama Devotees, all glories to the Sama Devotees, all glories to Sri Guru and Sri Gurunga, all glories to Sri Prabhupada. Well, I got a bunch of prayers here. I'm just going to do Om Gyana Chandasya Gyana Chanashakaya Chakshu Unga Tanyana Tazmashi Gurve Namaha Shri Tatanya Modustar Nishtapi Tanya Nabutale Swayam Rupa Kara Mayam Padati Sva Padanti Kam. I was born in the darkness of ignorance, and my spiritual masters opened my eyes with the torch of knowledge. I offer my respectful obeisances unto him. Namo Shri Rupa Goswami Prabhupada, who has established within this material world the mission to fulfill the desire of Lord Chaitanya. Give me shelter at his lotus feet. So, and Sri Krishna Chaitanya Purvamishan, Sri Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna. Yeah. Can't get enough prayers then. So, just do it. Is that it? Am I good? Just start. Om Namo. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
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 And that's when I would start saying Om again. After that, it doesn't matter. Okay. So I just do the verse. Just do the verse. No? I just said that. I would do that now. After Om again. Okay. So I can just do the verse. Remove force. So text 54, we're ready for that? All right. I got my prayers in, am I good? All right. So I was very grateful to whoever scheduled this class that this looks like Sanskrit I can pronounce. Okay, so. Jitasano jitasvasa. Pratya harita sad indriya.
Pratya harita sad indriya.
Hari bhavanaya dvasta.
Hari bhavanaya dvasta.
Rad raja sattva tamo mala. So, Jita Asana.
Jita Asana.
One is controlled the sitting posture.
One is
Jita Swasa. One who has controlled the breathing process. Pratyahrita. Turning back. Sat. Six. Indriya. Senses. Hari. The absolute personality of Godhead. Not just the absolute personality here. Yeah. He didn't just name any personality. Yeah. Just to get that straight. Bhavanaya. Absorbed in. Vasta. Conquered. Raja. Passion. Sattva. Sattva. Goodness. Tamaha. Ignorance. Malaha. Contaminations. Translation. One who has controlled the sitting postures, the yoga, the yogic asanas, the breathing process, can turn the senses towards the absolute personality of Godhead and thus become immune from the contaminations of the modes of material nature, namely mundane goodness, passion, and ignorance. Purport. Preliminary activities of the way of yoga are asana, pranayama, pratyahara, jhana, dharana, etc. Maharaj Dhritarashtra was to attain success in those preliminary actions because he was seated in a sanctified place and was concentrating upon one objective, namely the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Hari. Thus all the senses were being engaged in the service of the Lord. This process directly helps the devotee to get freedom from the contaminations of the three material modes of nature. Even the highest mode, the material mode of goodness, is also a cause of material bondage. What to speak of the other qualities, namely passion and ignorance. Passion and ignorance increase the material propensities of hankering for material enjoyment, and a strong sense of lust provokes the accumulation of wealth and power. One who has conquered these two base mentalities and has raised himself to the platform of goodness, which is full of knowledge and morality, cannot also control the senses. Namely, the eyes, the tongue, the nose, the ear, and the touch. But one who has surrendered himself to the lotus feet of Lord Hari, as above mentioned, can transcend all influences of the modes of material nature and be fixed in the service of the Lord. The Bhakti Yoga process, therefore, directly applies the senses to the loving service of the Lord. This prohibits the performer from engaging in material activities. This process of turning the senses from material attachment to the loving transcendental service of the Lord is called pratyahara, and the very process is called pranayama, ultimately ending in samadhi, or absorption in pleasing the Supreme Lord Hari by all means. So, the translation once again. One who has controlled the sitting postures, the yogic asanas, and the breathing process can turn the senses toward the absolute personality of Godhead and thus become immune from the contaminations of the mode of material nature, namely material, mundane goodness, passion, and ignorance. Okay. So I just want to, so Prabhupada, he's talking about how, a little bit, this is my take anyway, about how even material goodness is no good, you know, I mean, it's not good enough. And you know, my father just passed away. So I wanted to thank my father for always reminding me how I'm good for nothing. So that way, I never got attached to the material load of goodness. Yeah. So this is one of the benefits of growing up in America. So, but no, it's...
Did he mention your brains? Did he say something?
Something for what?
Something for brains. That's what he said.
I don't know. I didn't get that one. No. Something for brains?
Yeah. Brains.
Huh?
Stool for brains.
Okay. All right, I didn't get the full mantra. Okay, I got it. Yeah. Should I repeat that for the people in the audience? All right, now moving on to something hopefully relevant. I'm going to get these glasses back now. Jeez. Time is passing. Glasses, can't see. All right, glasses back on. But it is interesting that, look, material motive goodness is, a lot of ethics, religious rules and regulations, a lot of it helps the conditioned soul focus on getting situated in goodness, in the material mode of what we define in the Gita as the material mode of goodness. And partly why? A large part is because it's full of knowledge and morality. So it's a good platform for going to school, if you will, for taking up for self-realization, for introspection, for God realization. It's a good platform. It's like a nice, it creates a positive environment, a helpful environment, but just being in school is not good enough. There's plenty of, there's lots of danger in the royal road. Plenty of people get in trouble when they're in school. But it's a positive a situation. It's a helpful situation, and we want to create as helpful a situation as possible. I mean, in society that we live in, a lot of funding, a lot of effort goes into the school system to help people hopefully become productive adults, have the appropriate level of knowledge to function and contribute and so on and so forth. Though we would have a complaint that there's the department of the soul might be a little bit lacking in the current system. But the point being here, a lot of effort goes into creating a positive environment, but still at the end of the day, the individual has to take it up and perform, and just hanging out in school itself is not the thing. I swore I was never going to say I was a kid, but I do say it all the time, and I'm about to say it now. When I was a kid, I went to summer camp, and a lot of the counselors went to the University of Florida, and my impression from them is, from the things they were saying and doing, is Florida, somehow or other, right or wrong, University of Florida had this ferocious reputation for being a party school. And, those counselors, I think they had a certain balance where they did the party and they kept their folks happy with good grades. But, one can get lost in distracting elements, even in a facility as amazing, from an education standpoint as the University of Florida. So, motive goodness, we desire it. It's very facilitating. We want to pull back from the passion, the modes, the influence, or the attraction in the heart. There's so many things that are still in the heart that we may find ourselves, it resonates still. We want to pull back, at least with our intelligence. Maybe that's not, maybe I should turn that channel as quickly as I can, or at least turn the volume down on that channel. So passion and ignorance, it's a far more distracting energy, if you will. I'll put it in euphemistic language. But on the other hand, we can engage, it's all Krishna's energies. They're all Krishna's energies, and we can engage them all in devotional service. And no matter what energies or issues we may find that we have to wrestle with in the heart as we purify, we can engage. It doesn't matter. We don't have to wait for, I'm so situated in the mode of goodness. It'd be nice, and it's good to aim for that, definitely, but we don't have to wait for it. We can engage now, right now, whatever desire. And the thing is, we're all a mix of, it's not... All right, if I had to complain about my experience growing up in a Judeo-Christian background, from the stories that I heard that were drawn from the literature, it seems so, to me, a little bit simplistic morality tales. Actually, when I was a teenager, I was thinking, boy, this stuff is like ethics for people who live in the desert, or, have spears and stuff and herd sheep. And we're trying to apply them in the modern world, and it's a little bit of a gymnastic feat to do that. So that was my impression. I'm not saying that was an appropriate impression. That's the fullest realization of these things, but I do remember having that sense. And then, of course, as a teenager, by the grace of Prabhupada and the devotees, I got some books, and I got the impression, boy, there's a hell of a lot more, at least as far as where my heart was at and what it was open to receiving at that time. There was a heck of a lot more complexity here to parse through that was still in focus, that was very focused and direct. So at least for me, that was very, I found that helpful. So my point there, I think, is, let me go back a bit. Where'd that brain cell go? Oh, there it is. Okay, I think the point is, just the ethics is very helpful, but where does it go? Oh, that was the other thing that I realized, or at least it came to me. Oh, I'm reading the Gita, and oh, the point of all this ethics and morality and rules and regulations is to develop love of God, is to get you in a space to develop that relationship with God. Because as I'm suggesting here, I wasn't quite putting it together. I remember, when I grew up in the Jewish tradition, and when you're 13, you have the ceremony called the Bar Mitzvah. It's sort of like getting initiated into the, officially into the congregation as a participant. At that stage in cultural history, I think everybody was, the parents, they'd grown up, depression, whatever, and a lot of their parents came over from the old country, and now 60s, 70s, they had a lot of material opulence by the grace of God, by the grace of there was a little bit of my big fat Greek wedding thing going on here with these bar mitzvah ceremonies. How big of a bar mitzvah did you have? And the other competition, amongst us kids was, how many gifts, how much money did you collect? We used to get money gifts, and I remember my uncle gave me $500 and my folks quickly swooped in and took that. And I'm sure they put it to good use. But anyway, it was how much money did you get? And I think I got about $3,000 or $4,000. But then I went to summer camp. I'm going to try to pull this back. With this kid named Ricky Kirshner, if you're listening, I remember you, Ricky Kirshner. His father was Don Kirshner, the big rock and roll guy. So, and he was bragging. He had this person and that person at his bar mitzvah, all these celebrities. And how he collected $13,000. That was our spiritual mess. That was what we were talking about. So maybe we weren't totally focused on the mode of goodness at that time. But, still, okay, here's the other side to that. Even though as conditioned souls we're working through so many issues, and some of them may well be in the mode of passion ignorance, it's all brought into this, even in my dim awareness at that time of what it was all about. I mean, it's a house of God, it's a religious thing, there's some higher principle here, if I don't get it. It's sort of, the human being, at least it awakens that message a little bit. It makes them aware. I mean, this just popped in my head. I have a pet rabbit, right? And it listens to Prabhupada tapes all the time, but we're not having any conversations about going to the temple and reading Bhagavad Gita yet, at any rate. But, in a human being, no matter, how dim we may be, we can readily, hey, you want to go to the temple, this and that, chant a couple rounds or whatever, or how much money did you get your bar mitzvah, we can have these conversations depending on what we're going through. So getting back to this, so the mode of goodness is very desirable, it's very supportive, but they all can be engaged. They all can be engaged. And in Varnashram, Dharma, at least my appreciation is, the Varnas are set up for, which mode is kind of prominent. People tend to attracted to people who are sort of resonating on similar topics. I like the Red Sox, you like the Yankees, get the heck out of here. So if you have similar topics of interest, it's sort of to help facilitate different, communities that may be a little bit more geared to the mode of goodness, hopefully, more passion and passion and goodness a little bit. Khatri is a very, very astute, but very much tuned into, I got to get this job done, I got to get that job done, how do I herd up all the cats, to get them, so the intelligence is directed, it's more goal-orientated, and then Vaishya's, there's a bit more passion and ignorance where it's very economic development orientated, and then, we say the Sudras might have more, what do I got to do today kind of a thing, and that's cool. I'm helping out. So you know, these different. Here's the thing: is in human life, it's like this amplifier. Is that not amplifier? A receiver or something, a radio that can get a lot of different channels. We see as far as how the piranhas, is the piranhas one of those. Oh, it's a famous one. The prophet always refers to it. But the one where it says 8,400,000, and 400,000 is human beings. And, you know, and we're thinking, or at least, you know, initially when I heard it, it's like, well, there's cats, there's dogs, there's this lineage, and there's this family, and Jonah, and all this stuff. Well, how the hell can you figure that out? It's a Linnaean system of categorization. Like, somehow that's eternal and real. And let me tell you something from history of science perspective. It's only a couple hundred years old. I mean, you know, it's a world of names. But, I mean, it's a very useful system, particularly when dealing with life forms on Earth. But I don't think the piranhas are really concerned about that. When they're actually, Prabhupada said that directly in the Darwin conversation with Shamsunda elsewhere. It's not, this is a different kind of categorization system. It's not the Linnaean system, you know, though Linnaeus was a theist. How is it that there's 400,000 human beings? And, you know, that's quick math. So it's at least, so what is that? It's about 8% of all the categories would be considered some sort of human. So what does that mean? So one way I appreciate it, you got to go back and look. I mean, Prabhupada said a couple of things, but it's all about consciousness. It's all about transmigration. That's the context of these discussions in the Puranas, particularly Vedas more generally. It's about the consciousness. Certainly from a bhakti perspective, transmigration, spiritual evolution is to facilitate development or regression, which in a broader sense could be part of the development. I mean, sometimes you got to step back to go forward. Of the conditioned souls, they journey through it. So it's about facilitating consciousness. And at one point in that Darwin conversation, Prabhupada was saying, the devotees are like, this is the first time they heard it too, for the most part in those conversations. This is all new. Those conversations took place in 73-ish, I think. This is real early. I mean, back then, I mean, gosh golly, so 73, devotee was in the movement 2 years, 3 years, 4 years. I mean, it's like, holy cow, they came from Satya Yuga or something. You know, they're ready to be, it was good times. I joined late 70s. Then it was like Tradas was my, I can't figure out these devotees. And Tradas started taking care of me and I kind of clicked with him. He was like my big brother, he really took, big uncle. But he'd been in the movement 10 years. This is like late 70s, like, holy cow, 10 years. Now 10 years is like, maybe they're a devotee, we'll see. But, anyways. So the devotees, the point is they're it's all new and the whole society, they're all pretty new, to it, at least within a conscious sense of it. You know, of course, I don't think they were really new to it, because a lot of these people came, and they went by accident. They clicked with Prabhupada to help him. It was like an army of devotees were here waiting for him. But at least in a conscious three-dimensional sense of time and space, it was new. And they're all, it's like a lot of the same questions. What do you make of this? And it's in an environment, not that everything is so lovingly supportive now in the larger sense, but boy, it would seem a lot more antagonistic in certain respects to just religion in general and what to speak of the Krishna tradition, which was so, it wasn't Anglican Christianity, I will tell you that. And it's just coming out of the British period. Going back to my dad, so he's born in the 30s. It's still the British Raj time. And really, from their cultural perspective, the established generation, I mean, India was not, I mean, there was a reason, Britain justified hanging on in India. And there was a little bit, at that point, codependent analyses of why. India did not have the most flattering a reputation at the time, and I lost that train. But we're doing this tradition, and it's a big break from the trajectory that we have been, our parents' expectations, let me tell you. And here we, I caught the end of this. I can't speak with full authority, but I was a baby, baby boomer. And so I could get, it's like these guys were like my the older brothers and sisters, my friends, you know, so some similarities of experience. Anyways, the whole society, in one sense, is going through the same kind of issues all at once together. They all kind of grew up with the same cultural background as a broad brush principle. And now the challenge is, you know, it's sort of like being teenagers. We're all in this together. We don't have a, I know a little bit about this, and you know a little bit about that. And together, maybe we could be half of an adult if we get 10 of us together or something and figure something out. I remember reading those Prabhupada speaks out, and I think they were a little bit pumped up, like, yeah, you know, I'm a guy, right? Prabhupada's giving it to him. Back off. You know, don't give me any of this, you know, that word you were euphemistically referring to. I'm good, you know, and so it's a bit of a chutzpah. You know, whereas the experience, perhaps the ballast was still in a development phase at that point compared to, you know, now here we see in Alatra, you know, it's not uncommon to see somebody hang around 40, 50 more years, you know, with children, you know, the second generation. It ain't the youth ministry anymore for them. It's like the middle age ministry or something, you know, the old people ministry, you know, and you know, they got kids and sometimes grandkids. This is at least within a Western context of transplanting this tradition, there's a lot of depth of experience. And that perhaps wasn't present to that degree. Short of Prabhupada, I think, like, I remember hearing, oh, there was two adults in the movement. There was Prabhupada and Jayananda. Life experience was in the early stage. So what's my point? So they're in these conversations and speaking with Prabhupada, and I'm projecting, but it's like to hear Prabhupada speak strongly about something, you know, amongst all this adversity, this apparent adversity, and also, you know, our lack of experience. You know, it's like sometimes you hear those conversations, and it's like the devotees, they're playing the role of this or that, but it's like, hey, how much of that is your doubt, buddy, you know, too? You know, and it's natural, you know, and so either presenting these doubts and challenges and questions. So the point of that is, you know, they're asking Prabhupada these questions, and Prabhupada, and this is the first time, you know, a lot of us have heard it with any complexity. And Prabhupada is talking to people who are somewhat new still, and he's bringing this wealth of experience, and he's got to boil it down sometimes into, like, you know, like you talk to a kid. It's not like you start talking, you know, quantum physics when you're talking about, you know, how the world works. I mean, you got to give it to them in a phrase that they, you have to come down to their platform. It's not like you turn into a, you know, 10-year-old. Well, I'm teaching the 10-year-olds, now I'm 10 and I have no realization. No, the point is you come down to, in one sense, that 10-year platform so you can relate to these 10-year-olds and help them, but you're drawing upon your breadth of adult experience and bringing it to the 10-year-old so they can connect to it, so that they can connect to your adult experience and help, and this way you create for them a path forward. It's not like you come down to the 10-year-old platform, and now we're going to institutionalize 10-year-old consciousness as the destination, and we're not going any further. No, you relate to the 10-year-old platform, and I don't teach 10-year-olds, but this is theoretical knowledge. And then, but the point is, you connect with them on the platform where they're at, and then you bring them forward, drawing upon your experience as an adult, and having some mastery of whatever the specific subject matter may be, which is almost an excuse to get the association for broader principles. All right, so getting back to the point, I know there was a point there, we're getting back to it. So the point was 400,000, Jagovind is messaging me here. This is distracting. Oh, okay. Hey, buddy, wait till after class. Well, yeah, it doesn't take me long to get distracted. I guess he didn't know who Don Kirshner was. Yeah. Yeah. Hey, next time stay in class, you can save it for questions. So I had a point there. This is what. So 400,000 species, and they're trying to figure it out. And anyways, you go back to those conversations and you dig it out. We have the, this is amazing. We have the recordings and they have the transcripts. And you can really, if you so desire, really parse how Prabhupada was engaging with these people. It's like, you know, how he actually worded himself It's like a reflection of his consciousness. Words in themselves are like metaphors or whatever, you know, the words, the world of names. But there, you know, language, it reflects our consciousness, you know, books, literature, type. It's, you know, in this way we can plug into each other's sense of consciousness and so forth. So, you know, why did he choose these certain words? Why did he respond to this person that way? What did this person say that, therefore, a Prabhupada elicited this sort of response? So you can really parse it and study it deeply. We've been benedicted. It's not just, I mean, the oral history is great, but people have recollections of what they remember hearing and saying. This is natural. And it's like, you know, I could be, you know, listening to a Prabhupada lecture and, you know, he's saying all these amazing things, but there's a couple issues in my heart that day, and he says a couple of things. It's like, wow, that's what I needed to hear, and that's what I'm going to remember. Like, that's what the lecture was about. And that's natural. But but we also have the full recording and the transcripts to study. You know what? Maybe there's more, you know, there's more there to mine, is that the right word, to enter into, that's there, and we have the benefit by the grace of modern technology, we can go back and study these things deeply. So getting back to the point, there is a 400,000 species for humans. They have one way I was able to appreciate it, and this is open for discussion because this is a scientific process, and you know we do our research and we present it to our peers, and then we review it. You know, in the human form, there's a breadth of facility for expression of consciousness. Now, if you're a bunny rabbit, I got bunny rabbits on my brain. You know, there's only so much, it's more restricted, you know, but I have to, on behalf of my bunny, which is a very sattvic bunny rabbit. But still, very limited as compared to the human form for expressing and interacting, or a cat or a dog. I mean, I got a few animals. I mean, I'm impressed how dogs, you know, that form facilitates a sort of emotional in tune to human beings sometimes. But nonetheless, the dogs have a little bit of a problem taking baths regularly, and so on and so forth, diet issues and so on. So the human beings have more facility, and you know they have the facility for expression ranging from an angel. I'm using Western language to the scourge of hell, or you know, whatever. You know, there's, you know, we've seen it in 20th century. We've seen so much, the range of human expression. So we have that comparative freedom of expression facility to utilize within the human form. Hence, getting back to the point of Varnashram, you know, it's a way to facilitate the expression of the different modes in within a human cultural setting. Certain worldviews that are facilitated by various interactions with these energies, you know. So it's a way to facilitate these communities that tend to congregate about different worldviews, influenced by different attractions to various modes, in a way that everybody benefits and society. It's a more efficient way of organization. It's not somehow magical in itself, like pixie dust. Oh, we established Varnashram, and everybody's just going to hop, skip, and jump. But it's a proactive way of considering how to organize large groups of human beings, or at least considering, you know, how we interact respectfully and proactively and constructively within a context of large human beings. That human form has so much facility for different modes of expression. And you know, and this is one way to consider how to interact with different groups. And people do, you know, congregate together with like-minded people. So hey, that group there, they might be a little bit kind of grooving on Kshatriya Bhav issues, you know, and that's cool. And this group might be a little bit more into Brahminical issues, so that's cool. So you know, we can get a sense of the landscape and how to proactively engage. Point being, though, is here. Back to the point. That's in the verse, that even if you're a Brahminically inclined in the mode of goodness, that's still not good enough from a bhakti perspective. And the modes are constantly churning. And within this tradition, we see so many examples. It's not like there's anything being hid here, because this is part of life, and it has to be dealt with. And these examples are there in the scriptures of Brahmins going bad, if you will. You know, and then how do you deal with that? I mean, this is life. It's a little bit sophisticated and complicated. Complexity abounds. Speaking of complexity, Maharaj Yudhisthira, who's Dharmaraj, you know, he's constantly going to, whenever he gets a chance to talk to some realized sage, he's asking him all kinds of questions about, well, what about this situation? What about that situation? You know, it's ongoing dynamic process. You know, it's not like a doctor, you know, cures patients, right? It's not like, well, I got my five medicines, I'm done, you know? It's constantly learning, it's dynamic. You know, bhakti, it's dynamic. Life is dynamic. It's not this impersonal thing. We reach some plateau, and that's perfection, and everything gets locked down, and we've arrived, and now we can just watch TV all day, or whatever the heck they do, in, you know, whatever that concept of liberation might be. Oh, I'm grooving. I don't know. It's not like, or Aristotelian too, it's not like there's this, you know, in Greek, you know, this Platonic thought, there's the perfect world where everything, you know, the perfect triangle, the perfect this, the perfect that. And there's some truth to that, and then, you know, this is a reflection of that, however imperfect. There's some perfect to that, but it's not frozen, oh, the triangle's eternally this. It's dynamic. Everything is dynamic in bhakti. So, anyway, so as far as our application of the principles of bhakti yoga or spiritual life, I mean, just like Maharaj Yudhisthira, who's Dharmaraj, who understands ethics, who understands these things, morality, constantly, how do you apply it to this situation? What about this? What about that, these people? What about that? You know, Guru, Sadhu, and Shastra. So he's engaging that principle. When he sees sadhus, he's ready to learn more. He's ready to expand his knowledge base, if you will. And he's king, and he's Dharmaraj. And his heart's still open. There's always more. It's a dynamic process. It's expanding. So it's not that we get to the mode of goodness and that's it. It's not in itself good enough, but it is extremely facilitating for developing higher principles. It's like a supportive environment for cultivating transcendence, and thus we go through so much endeavor to create an environment, the temple, you know, so many things we work so hard to do to facilitate this very foundational, like, energy, if you will, as a prominent, supportive environment for then engaging in bhakti and transcendence. And there's some, geez, you take so many notes and then it's like, forget it, you just, you know, but then it's like, here, okay. There's food. Okay. Well, here's, okay, Maharaj Dhritarashtra was able to attain success in these preliminary actions. You know, he's doing this yoga, and it took him 5 days. Later on, Narada at the end of the chapter says, well, this is what he's doing now. Narada Muni is relating to Yudhisthira and Sat. Sanjaya, you know, what's happening? They're lamenting, whereas Dhritarashtra, and they, you know, hey, whatever problems that Dhritarashtra said, he apparently had a good side too, because these guys were generally lamenting, and they weren't just like, you know, foolish people. Oh, just some, you know, like the guys say, they're so sentimental. You can't say that about Maharaj Yudhisthira and Sanjaya. You know, they were, it's Dhammaraj. Sanjaya was basically the first person to hear the Gita. And who was the other first person to hear the Gita? It was Dhritarashtra. I mean, I could say Arjuna was the first person to hear the Gita, but he was part of the Gita. You know, he was the Gita. Him and Krishna, it's that dance between them, is the Gita. And so the first people to hear it is Sanjaya and Dhritarashtra. So I don't think they were just, happened to be at the right place at the right time by accident, you know. Anyway, so here's Dhritarashtra. So here he is doing these preliminary things. So it's not like he's spending, you know, we sometimes say, oh, you do all these other yoga processes, and then after many lifetimes, you come to bhakti, and then you can join us, going to chant Hare Krishna. You know, look, we're all townies at heart, right? But no, there's some truth to that. He took up these yoga processes in 5 days. He was done, man. It wasn't like he was wasting a lot of time with it, even if we want to consider that that way, which obviously I wouldn't, unless it's a bad thing, and then I would. But whatever's Mookie says, that's what I think. I'm just joking, Mookie, don't get mad. So he's sitting in a sanctified place and was concentrating upon. So how did he get through all these preliminary processes so quickly? He was sitting in a sanctified place, you know, in the temple, whatever. Whatever sanctified place you can find, that's the place to be. You know, a place where, you know, it's very conducive. And was concentrating upon one objective. And that's what the words are here that Prabhupada's writing. It wasn't like he was thinking, I want impersonal, at least according to this, maybe I'll be an impersonalist, or I want liberation. He's saying, I don't know all that's been written on this, but at least what's here in this purport, he was concentrating upon one objective, namely, the supreme personality of Godhead Hari. And because he was concentrating on Hari, thus all his senses were engaged in the service of the Lord, and through that, good, you know, passion, ignorance, goodness, whatever the problem was, there's no space left. There's no space left. I mean, the modes are there for people who don't want the real thing. You know, it's like you want an alternate reality, you get a false ego. I could be something I'm not. And I could do this, which really has nothing to do with me. So all this material energy stuff is for people who don't, you know, they want to do something else for whatever reason. And, you know, at least my appreciation, that's fine by me in one sense, because that's part of it. That, because love is voluntary, to freely give it, there has to be an opportunity to withdraw it. Because otherwise you can't freely give it. If I can only love, then it's forced. And that's not love by definition. Love is freely given. And so I have to have the opportunity to withdraw it in order to freely give it. It's my choice to give it. I don't have to give it. You know, so to freely give it means I don't have to, but I want to. So by freely giving the love, there's no time for anything else. They don't want anything else, because that's where the action is. There's no space for all this other stuff. So that's part of how we frame the process of devotional service, by engaging devotional service, by engaging the senses in Krishna consciousness, you know, is how we articulate it. There's no space for this other stuff. I mean, again, this is a very theoretical principle for me. And so his class yesterday, Giri Maharaj was just saying, he's talking to Prabhupada about, you know, this is us, right? This is a, you know, especially when we're early on, oh, Prabhupada, sometimes in Maya, and Prabhupada says, well, actually, it's more like sometimes you're Krishna conscious, you know. So, you know, we're working on it, you know, and he's like an exemplary, you know, person who's taking it up, so we're working on it. And part of it here is to engage the intelligence. It's not everything. There was a verse here in my notes, how Sanjaya, when he realized Dhritarashtra, who it says, oh, I'll find it. Sanjaya, you know, this is the guy who spoke the Gita first after Krishna and Arjuna, right? Because of, you know, you just hear, like, where's Dhritarashtra? Where did he go? And Gandhari. You know, these are great souls. I mean, maybe they're not as, you know, we there's so many great souls. Maybe they're not necessarily the top of our list of our favorite great souls. It depends on everyone. But they're very great souls. So Yudhisthira is looking. Where's my uncle? You know, where's Gandhar? Here it is. Marja is full of anxiety. Turna Sanjaya was sitting there. Where's uncle? You know, where's Gandhari? Auntie Gandhari and Mother Gandhari, says, and Uncle Vidura. And where'd they go? You know, I wanted to take care of them. Look, we've had some bad times, but, you know, I want to take care of them. And Sanjaya didn't know. He didn't know. And so because of compassion and agitation, he was freaking out too. Sanjaya, not having seen his own master, Dhritarashtra. I mean, Sanjaya, you know, he was aggrieved. He cannot properly reply. But he's freaking out, as we say. There's a lot of pathos here. First, a lot of emotional life here. First, he slowly pacified his mind by intelligence. It wasn't like, oh, Bhagavad Gita 5, 6, 7, I don't have a problem. You know, it's like you had to work through it and just get a grip, you know, and, you know, by intelligence. So the human intelligence is a very powerful tool. I mean, it's not like he just got lost in his intelligence and I don't have any feelings now, I don't have a problem. You know, it's like he used his intelligence. It's a, you know, used his faculties to kind of get a perspective, and wiping away his tears, and thinking of the feet of his master, Dhritarashtra. I mean, these are the people who first heard the Gita. You know, He began to reply to Maharaj Yudhisthira. So, my dear descendant of the Kuru dynasty, I have no information. He's basically saying, I don't have a clue. Oh my God, where'd they go? I don't have any information of the termination of your two uncles and Gandhari. I mean, they didn't, I mean, we already know the ending. They just left. Well, they have Alzheimer's and they're walking around the streets and, you know, God knows where they are. Somebody might have mugged them. I don't know. They just don't know yet. You know, what's going on? You know, where'd they go? Did the aliens get them? I don't know. You know? O king, I have been cheated by those great souls that they've left us. Anyway, so then Narada Muni came while Sanjaya was thinking, Narada Muni, Sri Narada, the powerful devotee of the Lord, appeared carrying his timbura, and he told him. He told him. He was there. And he told him, this is where we're at. Dhritarashtra and Godari, they went to, you know, this Himalayas, and Vidura, I guess, helped him along there. And, Dhritarashtra, he just walked in, you know, and got, you know, 5 days. He says, well, in about 5 days, the thing, you know, he's going to, you know, and Gandhari was right there with him. And I don't know the sati thing, but I think the pain of living in separation is greater than entering the fire. Is might be part of it, as opposed to you have a bunch of relatives who want the property and just drug her up and toss her in, you know, which may have been the complaint at the time of the British. Anyway, so then she left, and then Vidura was here. So this is at the end. So Vidura was there with him, and he sees all this was happening with these two. It was only about a week. And Vidura, so here's the verse. So Vidura, being affected with delight and grief. How's that as a mix of rasas? You know, delight and grief will then leave the place of the sacred pilgrimage. So it's a little complexity there. How do you balance delight and grief? I mean, here is within the context of this life. I mean, the whole Mahabharata is pretty intense, what they all went through. You know, is delight in their success and then grief that, you know, at least in the context of life, now there's this space, this separation. Having thus spoken, the great sage Narada, along with his Veena, ascended into outer space. It's like those old westerns where they just kind of right up into the sunset. My work is now done here. Yeah, like some, and then Yudhisthira too kept his instruction, kept Narada Muni's instruction in his heart, and was able to get rid of all lamentations. So, you know, I'm reading the chapters. That was easy. I just read the verse. I'm not lamenting about it. That's cool. But no, Yudhisthira, this is intense stuff. He thought about, you know, it helped him out. Because he was generally pretty upset about this. It wasn't like just for two verses. Oh, now he's over it, you know. It was like three verses. I'm good. That took about, 45 seconds to read, a minute and a half. It's good. No, it was generally he went through something. So all these issues of going through something, you know, we go through tough times, good times, bad times. I'm not going to sing the rest of the song. It's part of the process. It's part of the process to pull. I mean, Krishna's right there in the heart with us. All of us, everybody's best friend. Good times, bad times, he's pulling us through these things. And there's so much powerful stuff to learn from it. I mean, sometimes the tough lesson is the most valuable because it forces you to, like, confront yourself, issues, dig deep. You know, how do I? It's the challenge of it all. So Yudhisthira is going through a little bit of a tough thing here, and reconciling all this stuff, and Vidura, all of these participants, the whole Mahabharata, just one crazy pain in the neck thing after another, and yet it drew out. I didn't say any bad words, I don't think, there, but it just drew out so much stuff. So in one sense, that's one way to look at Queen Kunti's prayers. You know, the tough times are sometimes the best times. From a Krishna conscious perspective, they can be. So, with our intelligence, we can slowly perhaps consider those things and help bring ourselves get into a good spot to move forward, as Sanjaya also experienced. All right, I'm good. Hey, Divya, don't go, because if you're not okay with this, I don't know what the heck's going on. All right, is that good? Good? I'm all right, Brian?
Very good.
All right, we're done here. Not good enough?
Huh?
Is that not good enough?
Yeah.
Sure. Yeah, thank you. Thank you for that. I guess that. Yeah, actually, in one sense, it's because it's never, we have to keep pushing ourselves forward. You know, not that we've,
Hey man, I'm there. How about you? You're not there? I must be better than you. I must be more closer to Krishna because I can rationalize I'm better than you. Anyway, that's my advancement. I can think I'm better than everybody else. Maybe not. Anyway, that's the difference. All right, anybody got anything going on here?
I was thinking you mentioned top time is the best time.
Sometimes, yeah.
Yeah, and you get the reference of Mother Kunti. But the verse has a very significant in that verse. She said, because it brought her absorption on Krishna so close that this is giving her the security, stability, and that connection gave her such a happiness. She cannot duplicate make it happen again in a normal life when the intensity is not there.
It forces you to dig deep. And as bhaktas, you get to the madhya platform a little bit, then it's like I'm a devotee, and these issues I have to somehow reconcile with my sense of wanting to progress in Krishna. Whereas sometimes on the Kanishtha platform, it's more like a situation. I'm really open to this stuff. It's kind of cool, but if the situation's right, I'll groove with it. And if the situation's difficult, it's like, geez, I can do something else. Nonetheless, the attraction's there, because otherwise, the situation's right, I can do so many things. But in the madhya platform, it's like the ballast is there, and the tough time, I could engage it. It forces you to look inside. It's tough. It intensifies things, like Kunti's saying. I mean, her words are, therefore I think of Krishna, or whatever. But what does that mean? What are these anarthas in my heart, or whatever? And, I got to go through the inventory. And, thinking of Krishna means, I'm aware and experiencing and engaging in my relationship with Krishna. It's not just, also we engage thinking, but... Kunti, I can't speak for Kunti, Mother Kunti, Queen Kunti, but at least part of what she's saying certainly reflects, that. Sometimes tough times can be the most productive when you're trying to develop Krishna consciousness. You don't have to pray for them like Kunti necessarily, because they find you. They will come, But Kunti, I think the thing is, bring it on. She didn't care. She was fearless. Well, I saw her first, but she's seen you, right?
Yes.
All right, you're first. Junior devotees. Just
peace. When you mentioned that Dhritarashtra, he wasn't all bad. How could he be? Because he was the direct son, biological son of not just an illustrious sage, but the most illustrious sage, Srila Vyasadeva. So, how strange, somebody said yesterday that, how could he, he dealt with Krishna his whole life, and how could he be like that, so inimical towards him? But it just goes to show, Krishna's Leela, they have like cosmic casting.
Yeah, a lot of
and that means that Duryodhana was Vyasa's direct grandson, and so it's just just Krishna's Leela. But thank you for the nice class from the illustrious University of Florida professor and PhD. We appreciate it. Very interesting.
Piled high in me.
I always like your classes. It just opens so much to thinking. You bring so much into focus. You said love is free. You're free to give it love, right? Or else you wouldn't be able to.
Well, again, we're just discussing these things. I would say an essential quality of love is that it's freely given. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's by definition, if we're going to call something love. If I'm forced to, at work, I'm forced to show affection and respect, or I'm going to get fired or something. Mm-hmm. That's a little bit different than unadulterated love. But in a intimate relationship, I don't want to get into all the language we use, because immediately my mind flips to mundane pastimes. but that's a reflection of something deeper. You know, the love that's described, I mean, it has to be freely given. I want to be with Krishna. You know, I you don't have to be with, actually, we're always with Krishna, but the material energy facilitates, oh, okay, you're not, I'm not here. You can imagine I'm not here anymore if you want that. You know, you need some separate space, fine. You know, because, you know, to have a loving relationship, it's like you want to, you know, it's not like, you know, you're raising a kid, it's like they want to help you around the house. It's as opposed to you're forcing them to do. I used to have a list of chores. I remember once I was a kid. So I'm helping my mom one day. I see her working, and it dawns on me I could help her. So then I helped her do a couple of things, and then suddenly, wham! She gave me. I guess in her mind, boy, this kid can help me. And suddenly, I got a list of chores to do every frickin' day, and I refused to do them because now it was kind of forced. Whereas, you know, and I was supposed to do it, and I'm just, you know, and I'm a stubborn little brat. But you know, but when I was like, my mom's doing all this stuff was the initial thing, and she's my mom, and I want to help. I wanted to do it, and it was like joyful, but then it was like obligatory. It was like, what the hell, you guys can do this, why do I have to do this? I'm an American kid in the 60s, I mean, you should be taking care of me, you know? So, you know, it was a different, suddenly the rasa changed dramatically from me just wanting to help my mom to like, no, everybody, yeah, you got a job, pal, you know? So, so the love is freely given. Otherwise, it's something else.
Yeah, it was some talk. The difference between that and conditional love.
Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah. Like we saw with the gopis, you know, when Krishna left them, you know, they chastised Krishna, but in their heart they love you more.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's all churning it.
Yeah. And so, like you said, in the Rasa dance, when Krishna disappeared, all they could think of was, you know, Krishna, 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 all these different pastimes. And so like when he came back, it was like overwhelming. You know?
Yeah.
But in the mature world, we see mostly conditional love, don't we?
It's a reflection, and it's incomplete.
Yeah.
You know, it's, I mean, there's a little spark of insight, you know, and we're grasping for it, but it's, you know, not that we don't engage in that at all, but necessarily, but it's just a spark of his splendor, a spark. Yeah, everything, I mean, my intellectual appreciation here, time and space, it's all subservient to facilitating the relationships. I mean, here time is concrete and space is like, you know. But there, you know, I was on a parikram with Burijan and devotees and talking about Govardhan Hill. We went around Govardhan Hill and how it's playground of Krishna, and it's part of the play. It plays too with the cowherd boys. I mean, it changes, it facilitates, you know, it's like all in real time. It's like, you know, when we first got computer internet, it was like you're downloading a video and it keeps get hung up because the speed's so slow, but you have, you know, this and that. But no, the speed is, it's all in real time. And time itself, you know, here it's concrete and it just wears everything down, destroyer of the worlds. But there, at least my intellectual appreciation, that quality, I mean, there's a sequence of events, you know, but that quality of time is conspicuous by its absence, our concept of it destroying everything. But it facilitates, it's subservient. I mean, you know, the gopis, it was millions of whatever, you know, like billions of years. But then, you know, within the context of their pastimes as cowherds of Vrindavan, girls, women, you know, it's one night. So time is, everything facilitates there. As opposed to in the conditional realm, you know, we have our sense of some intimate relationship and we have to work so hard to make some space to just have that little spark of it. But there, everything facilitates joyfully that exchange. It's like swimming and diving in an ocean of nectar is the description. You know, that loving feeling. That loving feeling.
It seems like we're so limited, like you're saying, this concrete space here. If we don't get out of it, you know.
No, that's conditional life. We have these conditions.
Yeah, conditional life. Metaphysics, you know, you're hearing more and more of metaphysics.
Yeah.
Things you can't actually understand.
In our present condition.
Yeah, like present condition. Yeah. But then when it's removed, it's just
opens up. Unlimited, unlimited. There's no end to that. Because Krishna is unlimited. So there's a it's not like I got these convictions and I gotta negotiate with what I got.
Right.
But same thing should be open, you know. It's like in first grade, I gotta succeed in first grade. I can't be thinking, well, I'm gonna be a 10th grader, why am I pay attention to this. I mean, if I don't pass first grade, there ain't no second grade. So we're whatever we're dealing with now, but it's unlimited and expanding and not get all hung up. Well, I'm a really cool first grader. This is what it's all about, you know? You know, this is what we're going through. And, you know, I don't know, I can keep talking. But yeah, no, it's interesting. And it's all, because Krishna's unlimited. Even Radharani's example, you know, she was with Krishna, and there was this, I mean, this is how it's described to us as a lesson. She's getting a little bit, you know, hey, it's me and Krishna, you know? I mean, that's how I am, you know, in my limited way. And then Krishna, you know, wasn't like, oh, Radharani, who do you think you are? Forget it. Love him and leave him. No, he left, and it just intensified the relationship even more. So in one sense, you could say Radharani felt that just to get into that pastime, and then it intensified it even more. And then the gopis were like, now they're part of it, consoling Radharani. The whole thing just intensifies the whole thing. Whereas here, every little problem seems to just break, you know, is a tendency.
Yeah. I never heard that before. It's just like you said, you might
because the heart
one thing.
Yeah.
And then it's a whole different take. Like
yes. Yeah, that's the real thing. Is if we say Chi Hare Krishna, it purifies it because the heart is now open
yes.
more and it's receptive to more. And our intellect is subservient to the heart in that sense. Mm-hmm. You know, the heart, the seat of consciousness.